thought. Now we should be all right. And looks like everything is fine.
Good.
Okay, let's just begin by indicating that today is February 8th, 1995. And this is Jim Boning speaking with Dr. Norman Hackerman at his office at the University of Texas in Austin. As I indicated, this particular interview is designed by the Electrochemical Society in terms of talking to its past presidents, and we have an agenda that you have in front of you that I just sort of like to go through, beginning with your origins of interest in electrochemistry. And I know you and I have talked about that briefly before, mm-hmm. but maybe we could just review that for this purpose
sure.
now.
Well, let me give you a little background. At the time, I was at Hopkins, and you may have read someplace that there was a deep depression, so there was no rush to get out of the university, although I did get my degree in 3 years in the bachelor's. But I was doing two problems. One of them had to do with electrokinetic potentials, an electrophoresis problem. Another one had to do with sulfur monochloride, not related to electrochemistry. And somewhere along the line, I got interested in why the oxygen electrode wasn't reversible. We still can't make a reversible oxygen electrode. And I tried to do things with graphite. Had I known about fullerenes, I might have used them. But I got interested in electrochemistry by virtue of this irreversibility of the oxygen electrode. And that was in about 1935-36. It was followed by an early interest in some corrosion problems, which came, I think, from a consultancy arrangement. I'm not sure about that. And it was about that time that I became aware of the Electrochemical Society.
Was that through a professor, or was it? Were you aware when you were still a student?
I was still a student and just transferring into non-student, finishing.
Mm-hmm.
I really can't remember whether Dr. Patrick, the fellow with whom I worked, was aware of the Electrochemical Society or not. The other people on the faculty I know were not.
Okay.
He might have been. But I suspect it was because I began looking in abstracts to see what I could find out about the oxygen electrode, and I saw numerous references to the Transactions of the American Electrochemical Society, as it was then called. And that's what I think is the origin.
Okay.
I can't remember an electrochemist in my background,
okay.
my student background. So it probably was self-induced. It was in the second half of the 1930s, and it was instigated by this oxygen electrode problem.
When did you, you mentioned this earlier, not sure when you first joined the society, but what?
It was in the 40s.
In the 40s.
Yeah, okay. It was in the 40s. And again, I'm finding it difficult to remember whether it was before I came to this place or not. But I do know that I think the first paper I published came out of here in 1946. Now, I remember that pretty well because I was interested in the passivity of chromium. The paper is called something like Electrolytic Corrosion of Chromium or something like that. And it was in the Transactions of the American Electrochemical Society, 1946, and the student was Don Marshall, D.I. Marshall.
Okay.
That's the first tangible evidence I have of being in the society. I think I joined before that, but I really can't tell. I know I joined before that because, I've been in 50 years. And from
that would be 44, so
yeah,
or early.
At least 44 or earlier.
Right.
I developed a fairly good interest in corrosion while I was at VPI. 40, 41, 42, part of 43, and so I probably joined at that time. And I do remember that chromium paper because I'm beginning to get a little recall. It was the first paper I delivered.
Personally. Okay.
On my own. I was the chief in this case. I had to do it. And I came from here because I used these. Southern Pacific Railroad through San Antonio to New Orleans and then Birmingham. The meeting was in Birmingham, Alabama. And the format at that time was the format that the Fire Society used. You presented a paper, and there was a discussion afterwards, and then the whole thing appeared as a transaction. That was the only way you could publish with the electric company side.
Didn't the paper have to be submitted and written in advance?
It had to be submitted in order to go on to the program.
Okay.
Some peer review process there or something. But you couldn't just submit it to the journal, because mm-hmm. there was no journal at the time.
Okay.
And I can remember the long train ride, and I can remember talking to the guy in the University of Alabama who had said who had discovered element 87, alabamium, which later was overturned.
Gary, you got an order.
Same guy did.
Do you mind if I?
Yeah, no, go ahead. Same guy did virginium and alabamium, I think. You remember 85 and 87?
Oh, yes.
And at least the guy who did the alabamium was one I talked to at the Birmingham meeting. And it was my first real contact with society close up. I'd been to American Chemical Society meetings, but when you went to them, you didn't see the president and the mm-hmm. editor and all. It was already not a very cozy kind of meeting. It wasn't as bad as it is now. But the American Electrochemical side was different. This was a small group of maybe 200 people in one hotel, and they talked continuously, either formally or informally, for whatever number of days the meeting lasted, which I can't remember. So I was very much impressed by that.
Was there just a single session then of people giving papers?
I think there were no parallel sessions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they did dutifully, I don't know how they did it, whether with this or somebody transcribing it in shorthand or whatever. They took down everything that people said at in the discussion. That was all edited and the whole thing was published. Have you seen the early transactions?
No, I haven't seen the early transactions.
Well, it petered out shortly after, but from the time the society started in 1902 to 1948 or 49, it was all transactions.
Okay. How many other people did you meet at that time that you started making close contacts with?
Well, there were two people I remember particularly, maybe three. One of them was Bob Burns, who at the time was director of the chemical division of Bell Telephone Laboratories, a very prestigious position.
Know the name.
Yeah, Burns. Mm-hmm. Burns was a very able guy. He was a Princeton graduate, as I remember, PhD, and he was interested in materials. He's got a book on coatings. Mm-hmm. Another guy was Herb Ulig. Ulig was professor of metallurgy already, and had very high standing in the field of corrosion. He edited the corrosion handbook,
okay,
which still is to some extent a Bible type thing. And the third fellow that I got to know there was Frank LaQuey, who was vice president for research and development, I guess, at INCO, International Nickel, out of New York. Now, these three people had, established themselves pretty well. Remember, I was a newcomer, assistant professor here. And yet they were available. They sat and talked with you. And I'm sure there are others. The secretary of the society at the time, I can't remember his name right now.
A list of
he was at Columbia in chemical engineering. He'd been one of Colin Fink's students, I think. And he sure beat me up. kicked me all over the place for forgetting his name, but I'm sorry, I can't think of it.
I thought I'd find it in here, but I don't. Right away, there's a listing of all kinds of people, but I can't find the secretaries.
Back that far?
It's here somewhere.
It would be in the 40s. Anyway, those are the people I remember from that first contact. And I was pretty much impressed by him.
Well, we'll fill the name in. I just can't find it here off immediately.
Okay. And I've answered part of your four. It was a very homogeneous group of people. You know, they all had basically similar interests. There were already divisions, organic and electro organic and corrosion and something called physical electrochemistry. And let's see, what else was there? D&I, dielectric and insulation, that kind of thing. There are about a half dozen divisions, but the thing was so small that even though occasionally they might have had parallel sessions, most of the time everybody got together. And that was the nice thing about it. It was very noticeable relative to the ACS. Mm-hmm. Now you understand that the Electrochemical Society was not a spin-off of the ACS, but it was a breakaway. You know that story?
There's a little bit of it in here, but the ACS was reluctant to form a division of electrochemistry.
And Fink and Parsons didn't get along anyway.
Okay.
Not secondhand. I didn't know either of them directly. But secondhand says that there was a dispute, couldn't form a division, and Fink just seceded, I guess is the right word. There was another thing. The ACS at that time was pretty pure chemistry. I don't think they had any chemical engineering in it. I know they didn't have biochemistry because there wasn't any. In fact, there wasn't any chemical engineering when it formed. And the people who were in that in the first third of the century were chemists who enjoyed chemistry. And some of them, I know, got to the position of believing an application was dirty. It was prostitution. You know, and that still hangs on with some people. And electrochemistry at the time was predominantly application. Plating, coating, corrosion, that kind of thing. All of them less than acceptable in pure chemical circles. So it was easier to break them away. And you'll notice that the ACS doesn't have a journal of electrochemistry. It gets closed. Langmuir puts stuff in and separates it out. And the Journal of Physical Chemistry does the same thing, but they don't attract the good papers. I shouldn't say. They don't attract the better, you know, bulk of the good paper. So the society was a very nice place for a young guy to get involved. Of course, you could feel involved right at the beginning.
Would you say that the academics in the society were in the minority then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it had a sizable industrial leaning. Industrial electrochemistry was one of the divisions. Mm-hmm. Buffalo was a major site for meetings by virtue of the fact it was a center of electrochemical industry. Of course, meetings were all in the northeast someplace, but they got to Buffalo about every fourth or fifth time. And the only place in the society that had pure chemistry was physical electrochemistry, which was the thing that I joined first.
Okay.
I mean, the division to which I adhered first, and then corrosion came later. And I developed a pretty close friendship with Burns and with Ulig and with Laqui, for that matter, and with some others. Bob Mears, who was research director at U.S. Steel in Pittsburgh. No, aluminum company in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
Some others I can't think of right now. Morris Fontana, who was at Ohio State University at the time. All of these people were active. They were more, they were certainly less pure chemists than I was. So I held up the left wing of the society. But I had lots of interest in the application. I always thought that pure chemistry or pure science for its own sake was all right, but not for me. I preferred to have it tied to something. But when I got into that something, I tried to get as much purity as I could. When I got into the corrosion field, for example, word adsorption hadn't been used as far as I know. And when I attempted to explain inhibition, corrosion inhibition by adsorption phenomena, there was a certain amount of tutorialness I developed. But it did catch on, and I mean, it spread very quickly. And that, I'm not trying to say these guys didn't know what they're doing, but they just didn't have that same interest. But it was a very comfortable society right from the beginning. From the time I made this first trip in 1946, I pretty much went there not exclusively, but I stopped going to the others, to the ACS meetings, for example, except occasionally, because I retained an interest in non-charge transfer interface science, which meant that I had to go to the Calloway division of the ACS to get some of the things I wanted. And the society has remained. It's more complex now, but it certainly remained that way for 20 years, and then it began to grow a little bit. And I enjoyed it. I went to every meeting, you know, twice a year meetings. When they asked me to do something, I did it. And that's one of your questions here. I have a reason for becoming active in society member activities. People asked me to do it, and I did it. That's all I know.
Okay.
Of course, I enjoy the people, and I enjoy the field. Mm-hmm. And I think I was president in 55 or 57, something like that.
57.
So that was about 10 or 11 years after I got in with both feet at least. And I'd done an awful lot of work in the meantime for them. It was easy to do. And they needed somebody to run for a third vice president, so I said okay, and they got me. They still do it, third, the second, the first president.
Okay, that's the way it works.
And the president is the last year. Currently, I think the president stays on another year on the board, but then you rotate it off. So I rotated off in 57.
So you actually started that third vice presidency within 8 years or after you went to that first meeting?
Right, 57, 56, 54. Probably was elected in 54, so about 8 years.
Yeah.
But in about 49, Burns and Ulig got their heads together and decided that transactions was not the way to go, and that they had to go to a journal in the true sense of the word, where papers were submitted and accepted or rejected, published without discussion. And the society did go over to that, either in 49 or 50. Burns was the chairman of the publication committee, I think, and Ulig was the editor. They had a lot of trouble. They didn't get many manuscripts.
Hmm. Where were they going?
Well, I guess they began to spread out some. The National Association of Corrosion Engineers had started, so corrosion papers were going there.
Okay.
The industrial electrochemists were saying this is too esoteric for me. They're sort of getting out of the way. Journal of Physical Chemistry, got a few of them at that time. It was called the Journal of Physical and Colloid Chemistry for a while. And the sequence is not certain, but in about 1951, I remember Ulick calling me and asked me if I would take on the job of technical editor. He would be editor and do the writing editorials and worrying about makeup and all the rest of it. And I would take, and that would be sort of chairing the publication board, not the committee, but the peer review structure, which I did. So, and I did that till 1969, 20 years, at which time I became the editor. In fact, I've been the editor for a long time, in fact. After Ulick left, Cecil King of NYU became the editor. That's all, I think. Then I became editor. And I held that until 1989 or 90. So I was on that editorial activity from 51 to 90.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. And I did it through two presidencies, but I had a good lady working with me in each case. And the journal, which went through a trough, there was one issue that I had three papers in. Mm. And it probably was three out of four manuscripts that got through. But we began to talk it up at the Society because Society members were publishing elsewhere. And in about 2 years, it was back to being a full blast thing. The original size was that format. And we went to the full-size format, the 8.5 by 11. Probably by the time I was in the vice president's sequence, I did both of those at the same time. So I was president and technical editor at the time. And by the 60s, we were beginning to have the problem of, can we pay for this stuff? Institute of Page Charges, which we hadn't had before. We used to give away the reprints, which we had to start charging for. I remember we talked about advertising, and you know, it was an anathema to most of the people to go after advertising because that obviously is prostitution of the sort. But we did finally. And the journal now is a very robust journal. The society began to acquire interests which sort of came to the edge of, say, physical electrochemistry or dielectric and insulation. From dielectric and insulation, it wasn't hard to get to semiconductors. Mm-hmm. And first thing you know, we had lots of papers in that area, and we divided into electrochemistry and solid state, I think it's called. That's the way it's still set up.
At the time that it changed from transactions to the journal, did the meetings also change? That is,
yes.
You no longer had to submit a paper in
advance. You had to submit an
abstract. But yeah. You didn't have to submit
right.
The...
And the divisions began to grow as interest in the field stirred up. You know, there's a philosophic difference between the way chemistry was prior to the big push in the 50s and following the Soviet space.
It was Sputnik.
Sputnik, yeah. Mm-hmm. The more people came into the field, the larger and larger was the percentage of people in the field who were interested in application. Since the Electrochemical Society had that kind of a cast to it, it began to grow pretty rapidly because, I don't know if it's because, but a reason could have been that at that time the purity of the chemistry in the ACS was not something that the new people wanted to talk about. They wanted to talk about use. And in fact, a lot of societies started up. The NACE started up at that time and other corrosion societies. So. The Electrochemical Society probably gained by virtue of the fact that there was a sizable influx into the field of chemistry and the field of science, for that matter. And those who had a better appreciation for application began to show up in the ECS area. And the journal gained with it, so that it went from the three manuscripts to where I was, or three papers published, to where I was fielding 600 to 700 manuscripts a year. Mm. Particularly by the time I'd gone to Rice, it was at least that big.
What was your rejection rate? How did that fare over that time?
It wasn't too inconstant. I would say it stayed at about 20% of true rejections, and there were maybe 10% where authors were decided to withdraw. So I guess we published 6 to 7 out of every 10 we got. And it was lower at first and higher later, because people began to understand that they were getting scrutinized. They didn't submit papers that couldn't stand scrutiny.
Okay.
That's a fairly standard. I'm sure we got rejects from other journals at the beginning. But they got standard peer review by people in the field. This is before there was a certain amount of feeling of insecurity with some peer looking at your fresh work. Well, currently, people who write proposals are constantly concerned about the work being lifted. Same with papers, it's not as bad because they're a year behind everything else. But at first, the peer review was indeed just exactly that. People did look at it. They looked at it carefully, thoughtfully, and not with any other intention except to have nothing but the best stuff in the literature. Now, that's a different matter, but there are variations on that theme now which are disturbing.
In what way?
Well, it leads to turning down papers that perhaps ought to be massaged further and used. It leads to having ideas ahead of time rather than behind time. It leads to the kind of thing that Neil Gordon was trying to develop when he set up the Gibson Island conferences that became the Gordon conferences, namely conversations between peers from universities and from industry and government, without recorders, without photography, just talk, no notes. And the general understanding was that you would not go out and talk about this stuff until it appeared as a publication somewhere. stuck for a while, but it doesn't quite work now.
Were you the one who set up the peer review, or was that in place before you took over as technical editor?
We had divisional editors. Physical electrochemistry, corrosion division, P&I, industrial electrochemistry.
Okay.
And they were the ones to whom my job as technical editor was to look at the paper. I saw all the manuscripts and decide which divisional editor ought to deal with it and send it to him and occasionally her. There weren't a lot of hers. With some comments on it to begin with. You know, this looks like it's better get a good scrutiny, because I think I can't smell what it, I can't tell what it is, but I can smell something, that kind of stuff. Intuitive stuff. So at first I used to write on every one of them. Mm. But at 600 or 700 got a little tough. But when we're down to 50 I could do it. That's just one or two a day. So I suspect that the peer review system was in place when I got there. You would probably set it up.
Okay.
I'm going to be doing Amarillo's, what's it called? Amarillo Consortium ACNPR. It has to do with, what the hell to do with all the plutonium? You know, they got a plutonium plant up in Amarillo.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's the one place where they're still doing some research. And what do you do with all this fissile matter?
I wouldn't want to tackle that project.
Okay.
But we were talking about the peer review origins and I was going to ask you, you set up a pool of people that you send manuscripts out to that you have evidence to reason to believe that will be a good peer reviewer. Did you find that you had to massage that pool a little bit, that there were people that you couldn't rely on after a while?
You found out which people would you found out which people gave you cursory reviews. That was more important. Then you found out those that put it under a pile and you didn't hear from them for 6 weeks or 6 months for that matter. You also try to avoid the people who did gratuitous insults. You know, what's this guy saying? Instead of, this doesn't seem to be right. I mean, that's not quite the same thing, is it?
No.
So you did develop. We developed them through these editors, through these divisional editors. We had meetings twice a year, and of course, they were available on the phone and by mail. So I got to know pretty well. The problem was, in order to diminish the load on each DE, we had multiple DEs for each division. And first thing you knew, I had about 80 divisional editors. And became noticeable at these meetings. You had to talk loud. When I left, they went to a different system, and a better system. We didn't pay anybody anything, by the way.
Okay,
we didn't give them secretaries. I had a part-time secretary, but none of the DEs had secretaries. They had their own, but now they're just as, like the JACS does. They have 8 or 10 of these guys. They give them secretarial help, and they pay them $5,000 to $10,000 a year. So through those editors, I developed quite a package of people I could turn to for different kinds of things. Sometimes I bypassed the DE. If there was something I was particularly interested in, I'd do the reviewing myself. And I don't know where the lists are, but we had long lists of individuals. We never had to publish them at that time, you know. Up until 15 years ago, a review was a review. You might not like it. You might think
reviewer was a nut or a stinker or just both, but you didn't have much recourse. You had recourse to me. And I would go look at the whole package, and if it looked as if the author was really getting diddled, we'd send it to a different set of reviewers. And then if they were diametrically opposite, we'd go to a referee and review that kind of stuff. We spent a lot of time on those things.
Oh, I can imagine.
Yeah, but I mean, it wasn't done out of hand.
Well, you had so many other activities through all this period anyways. To me, it's astounding that you were able to do this.
Well, this
journal
was, this was a journal pile. This was the other pile.
You, as you said, you must have had some efficient help.
Oh, yeah. In fact, one of the lady in Houston is still down there, Jackie Bourne. She was great.
Well, all right.
You want to know what other pre-presidential activities? I think I've told you. I didn't fiddle with sections or divisions. Publications were what I did all my...
Well, but I did read someplace that you were on a committee that, way back in 1950, that designed the Palladium Medal.
Oh, yeah. That's right. That was one of my... I forgot the number. The idea of the Palladium Medal stemmed from a number of places, but I think Ulig was and Burns were the main... They were the real drivers in that society for 10 years. And they... And the society had a... industrial electrochemistry medal, which I ought to remember because I got one of them with a name on it, and that's about all he had, that one. And Herb wanted to have something in physical electrochemistry that sort of personified the theory, the less practical side of the house. And it was, I'm sure it was his idea to use the word palladium. Pallas Athena,
yes,
is a goddess of some Greek goddess of something, and that's where that came from.
Okay.
As you know, palladium's a nice white metal. It's more or less stainless. In fact, it is stainless because its corrosion products don't discolor the system. And the sketch of the metal was to draw her on the front. I don't know who was on the back. I got one of them. Looked at it for a while. Well, I think maybe there's an electrochemical society seal on the back.
Okay.
And Carl Wagner got one of them. Yuda got one of them, the early ones.
And you got it in 65.
65, yeah. They came every other year, I think. Mm-hmm. Still do, I believe. Yeah. I served on a number of little committees, but I don't remember those things, actually.
Okay.
The big things I can remember, the editorship I can remember. But I didn't have a local section to belong to because there weren't any down here. The divisions, I did work in the corrosion division and the physical electrochemistry. I'm sure I was chairman of both those divisions at some time. You say I was on the Palladium Award Committee, I probably was. Other, I don't know. I was always busy at those meetings, I know that.
Oh, I have here, you were chairman of the corrosion division in 50-51. So that first 10 years you were a member of the society, you were extremely busy within the society.
Yeah.
You really were.
I think they were looking for a sucker. but I wasn't a sucker in the sense that I enjoyed it, so I didn't. I didn't particularly want to be president, but that's the way it works. The important thing about the society at the time was it was always broke. I mean, they were always sucking air for money. And it was about in that period, in the middle 50s, that we decided to go after advertising. We also, I think at that time, decided that each of the divisions really ought to take a look at itself and see if their charter was correct. And there were some variations. There was an abortive effort to establish another journal. It was called It lasted only a short time, 4 or 5 years. What was it called?
I remember reading about was that the electrochemical technology?
Yeah, electrochemical technology. It was an attempt to to reestablish a position of the society as being industrially oriented. I think what Jülich and Burns and I did was to switch it into not a theoretical society by any manner of means, but a greater appreciation of background chemistry on which everything else is based. And some of the people in industrial electrolytic, you know, who flew by the seat of their pants, and other such, and Dee and I was saying dielectric insulation the same way, you know. You knew what was a good insulator and you made a small variation on that. They actually didn't like it. In fact, that probably led to the establishment of some small societies that were specifically oriented toward electrolytic industries, that kind of chloralkali. And that electrochemical technology was designed to show that the society was interested in that area. It failed because there just wasn't enough interest to keep it loaded with papers. And it became a burden to have two journals when, in fact, one was sufficient. And the burden, when it became evident fiscally to the industrial people, they quit backing it, and then disappeared.
It would seem that the industrial people would be reluctant to be publishing papers anyways.
Well, they like reviews. See, they want lots of reviews.
Okay.
In fact, every division had a review every year.
Okay.
And we didn't have room in the journal with all the manuscripts that were piling in. And the ones who were being peer-reviewed didn't really like the idea of being mixed in with a bunch of reviews that were not peer-reviewed. And you couldn't peer-review those, really, because you went to the expert and said, tell us what happened last year in the chloralkali industry or in the aluminum production industry or whatever. And you went to what you thought was the best person, so who could peer-review them. There were no peers. Anyway, the editors would have to read that stuff and decide whether the fellow was talking about paint and its formulation and application knew what he was talking about, and the editor didn't know. And if he had sent it out to somebody in the field, the author would hear about it. So it was, started out dead in the water. Now, the one they're doing now, the interface one, it's quite different. I don't know if you know Interface.
No, I don't know.
That's a second journal.
Okay.
It has review articles in it. How they review it, I'm not sure, because I've never been involved with it. It has all the news, all the meeting paraphernalia which we used to publish in the journal, you know, couple tens of pages a year. And all that's now in the quarterly journal called Interface, which has a lot about, for example, the winners of the Young Authors Award, that kind of stuff. Very, very nicely done. It takes a load off the journal, but it doesn't put an unbearable load on trying to find these review papers. So now I notice that the editor of Interface has now been move to editor of the journal, the new Interface editor.
Had you, at this point, when the electrochemical technology started, had you had more academics joined the society by this time?
And yeah,
they through had, your influence,
they had increased. I don't know whether it was my influence or not, but more of them came, mm-hmm. and the industrial people who came were younger and more apt to listen to the university people. Now, the university people never did learn to listen to the industrial guys. That's an overstatement, but you get the flavor of it. Mm-hmm. The society went from several hundred to a few thousand members, and the ratio of academic to industrial probably never varied a whole lot, but the voices were predominantly academic. And for the time I was very active in there, that certainly was true. I guess the other things we did were to... We couldn't emulate the ACS. For example, we couldn't have an employment clearinghouse of any great consequence. But we could have a little thing, much more informal, to help people get jobs, for example. And we did set one of those in place, never call it a clearinghouse. That would have been overblown. Our meetings would have 1,000 to 1,200 people there. ACS meetings have 10 to 12 or 15,000. Incidentally, the proportion of members who came to meetings was much higher in the Electrochemical Society than it is in the ACS. Mm. See, the ACS gets 10 or 12,000, but they got 150. Right. And we'd get 1,000, and we got 4,000. So it's
quite a difference.
Yeah. And it was characteristic of the differences between the two, because, as I say, the society members knew each other, more or less.
How did the dues structure compare? I don't have any feeling for that at all, but...
It did not escalate anywhere near like the ACS did, because the superstructure is still very small compared to the ACS. I think there are probably 6,000 or 7,000 members now, and the number of people in the Pennington headquarters doesn't exceed a dozen. Now, the ACS has 150,000, 20 times as much, but they probably have 600-700 people working for them in those two big buildings in Washington. And they've become a lobbyist group. They wouldn't like to hear that, but they go on the Hill a lot. How's that? That kind of thing. They're much less. The percentage of technical aspect is less than it is for these smaller societies, like the Chemical Society being a case in point. I've always been concerned about the ACS no longer being a scientific society.
Well, let me ask another general aspect about ECS, and that is I don't remember seeing anything about a focus on education.
No, that really was. Still isn't, as far as I know.
Was that done purposely?
No, I think just by difference.
Okay.
Or indifference. They never looked on that as being a major target for them. At no point in my time with them. When I was editor, I rarely wrote editorials. I thought they might have massaged the ego of the editor, but by and large, there wasn't much point to it. I did write one once. I'm not sure I ever got it published. But occasionally, I'd edit the manuscript just for the hell of it. And this was probably a 15-pager. And I've always been concerned about the number of words that people use to say what can be said in 5 or 6 or 7. And I edited one manuscript and took the word "the" out. And I took it out enough time to fill a page.
About 250 of them. And I know I considered writing an editorial of nothing but these. And I can't remember if I ever did that or not. But I've never been compelled to write one.
While we're just mentioning the education aspect, did electrochemistry ever come into its own in an academic environment? Were there any places that gave courses? It wasn't a standard kind of...
Chemical engineering is some...
Okay.
A little better. Chemistry, no. Except in a few places. I had it here, for example. Fontana gave it at Ohio State. Euler gave some at MIT. But not in the chemistry department. His was in metallurgy. Fontana was in chemical engineering. Mine was chemistry. The answer is no. At best, it was two lectures in physical chemistry. Now, it's quite different now. Electrochemistry is big stuff these days. I mean, the organic chemists use it, the biochemists use it. And it's a great tool. You know, you've got the kind of control that you, before lasers, you didn't have with light. So, it works very well.
But if you didn't, if all you had were two lectures in physical chemistry, how did you get people to become electrochemists? Like you did as a...
Yeah. Here, here I'd give my version of what was a good PhD problem. And a lot of them... Now, the ones that I got, I must say, had a predilection toward applied stuff. I've had about 70 PhDs, I guess. And I'd say 15 of them went into academic work, maybe 20. Other physical chemists might be the reverse. So most of mine went into industry, by preference.
Was the society able to attract engineers, chemical engineers?
Yeah, here's the way they became attracted. A guy would get a chemical engineering degree and go to work for Monsanto or Exxon, and they'd assign him a corrosion problem. And he'd quickly come to electrochemical side and find out what that was, what to do next. They went there at the NAC or both. You know, back in the earlier days, going to meetings was a fairly simple thing, the 50s and 60s and 70s. Now it's not so simple, but yeah, they did it by virtue of jobs that they picked up.
One of the people I'm going to see next month is Charles Tobias.
Oh, yeah.
Who is an electrochemical engineer.
Right. And he coined the term, as far as I can tell.
Okay. And so I'm wondering what influence he had in the society in terms of attracting people to this.
A great deal. Tobias is a first-rate scholar, and it, you know, stands out all over him. So he certainly attracted some very able people at Berkeley to work in his lab, and his influence in the society was big. He was one of my divisional editors.
Okay.
And for a very long, in fact, the whole time I was there, I think, just about from the time he came until I left. And you'll find that his influence was sizable, particularly in mass transport problems and electrolytic processes. Some of his better students are really high-standing people.
Just as an aside, I think the other person they sent a letter to, I just found this out before I left, is Reed.
Oh, yeah. Who's in Harold Reed.
Is in Florida.
He lives in Florida now. Yeah. He was at Penn State at the time. Reed was actually the first technical editor, I think, of the journal.
Okay.
Now that you mention it. I believe that when Euler started that, Reed was his technical editor. And then, I don't know what happened there. That's when they brought me in. Harold had a pretty good influence, I would say. You know, he came from a good school, and is a very active and thoughtful guy. But he didn't spend nearly as much time as I did, for example, on society. Not after a while. He was president before me or after me, I can't remember.
I don't remember.
Let's see. You were 57, and he was 66, so he was after.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then Tobias was 670.
Yeah.
I just noticed a name here. Ulig was 55, but I saw the name of Veazey from Dow.
Yeah.
Yeah, W.R. Veazey.
Would have been early.
45.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that Dow people would have been very active in this
Absolutely.
Society.
Absolutely, they were. Yeah. They were.
At this point, let's talk about, you already said they asked you to run for third vice president, and you said yes, and that's how you became
that's
president.
That's the line.
At that time, what kind of an agenda would you have in mind, or what could you use that year as president for in terms of exerting a lasting influence on the society?
Well, I got to think about that a little bit. I don't think presidents have a great deal of influence on society, to get right down to it. Society has a momentum of its own, and the very important people of the staff who are dedicated to it. But what you can do in the several years that you have contact is to, if the society was getting too theoretical, is to push it back to a more moderate position, or too industrial to push back to a moderate position. And the big thing was to make that journal work during my time. If the journal failed, the society was going to close down. That was the thing that it had going. And I spent most of my time on that and trying to make sure that the meetings were of the kind that the members wanted. And you could detect that better back then when we had our meetings in places like Buffalo and not Honolulu. Honolulu, you can't tell whether it's the papers or the place. But Buffalo, you can. I'm not picking on Buffalo, but.
No, I understand. That's a good point.
You know, Birmingham, Alabama, kind of thing. So it was to make the society as effective and useful to the members as possible. And the other problems were all nitty-gritty. How do you pay for this? Is a dues high enough, or is it too high? Or are three people too much for the staff? Not enough, that kind of thing. So it was a management problem. Philosophically, the society, I thought, was doing what it was supposed to do. And it had its hands full paying for the journal.
Did you have to maintain a public interface that year? Did you go out on the road?
Yeah, I went to. It doesn't have nearly the number of sections that ACS has, but I'd say I went to 10 of them. Concentrated in the east, because that's where most of them were. There was a section down here by that time. There was a section in Los Angeles. There was a section at Hoover Dam, because the titanium plant that was in that little town right near, between Las Vegas and the dam. There weren't a whole lot of sections, but I went to maybe a quarter of them, maybe a third. And that, you know, that's kind of worthwhile. People see that there's somebody live out of the headquarters. But it's not a big thing. The big thing was to maintain the finances so that you could do that which you thought was important. And the two things that were important were the good journal and the good meetings.
What kind of feeling did you sense from the meeting with these local sections? Were the members happy, or did they give you good feedback for improvement?
They were not unhappy, because I won't say I didn't find any suggestions for change that were of some use, but I don't think there were a whole lot of them. They knew what they felt, but they didn't know anything about the workings of society. So I tell them how it works, how it worked, and then there's what changes would you make it, you know, if that were the arrangement you had to deal with. Basically, the problem was, you know, occasionally the dues were too high. They were $15 at the time or something like that, which was pretty good size money. Or it's too far to go to get to the meetings. You know, they have the meetings closer to me, say, have it in Cincinnati, because I can get to it. Or you jokers don't know a good paper when you see one. That kind of stuff. And I'm not being derogatory of the business of moving around, because you can't tell when the good idea is going to come. So you have to scrub the place. But by and large, there was no major complaint. It takes too long to review a paper. It used to take 8 months or 9 months from taking the paper in to publishing it. Now it takes about a year and a half or a year and a quarter. And they didn't like it then, and don't like it now, right? So my answer is, you know, the combination of concern about the length of time always led us to a study of how long does it really take, and whose fault is it that it takes so long, because after all, the authors are involved with it too. And if the author holds it for 4 months and it takes 8 months, that's not bad. That kind of lecture I'd have to give them once in a while. By and large, it was nice give and take, and I think they felt they knew more about the society. I didn't always take away a feeling that I learned anything, except that there are certain common complaints, and they are common. It just spread across the whole thing. And most of those complaints you can't do a whole lot about, but you might be able to do something about it.
You've indicated that all of your division editors were volunteers with no pay at this time.
Correct.
You had a part-time, were getting some money for us, part-time secretary.
Yeah.
What about the year that you were president? Did you finance your traveling and everything, or did
they? No, the society paid for society travel.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure of that. I don't think this place would have done it. Back then we had some pretty archaic things. You know, if you flew, you were on one per diem until you crossed the border. And then per diem changed. I flew or train, you know.
Uh-huh.
But inside the state you were, say, on $6 a day, and outside the state you were on $8 a day. So travel was not that easy at that time.
And how was it working with the society's headquarters office?
All right. We had some nice, what I consider nice people and able people. I went through two or three, in my total period, I went through three secretaries, three society secretaries. I'm not talking about the staff.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all good people. They all, I think, did very well. The society obviously doesn't, I don't think, is competitive in wages and other emoluments. In fact, they moved out to the country, to Pennington, to sort of compensate for what they couldn't pay in New York. And in fact, that was a good deal. They got better people who didn't want to live in New York. That's what it meant. So, it's never been a high-paying place. If you wanted to make the most money, that's not the job you take. But they're hard-working people. Linford, Henry Linford was so
okay.
I don't know why it suddenly popped in.
We've talked a little bit about accomplishments and problems. Anything else you want to add to that?
No, nothing I can think of.
Okay. We've talked a little bit about the relationship of the society to ACS, and maybe looking at it in its relationships to other societies, because you said there was Corrosion Engineers had their own organization.
I would say that the society wasn't standoffish, but there wasn't a whole lot of overlap between it and other. I think it looked on itself as being closer to the Faraday Society than anything else. In fact, we once talked about calling it the Gibbs Society in order to be more nearly parallel. And the transactions were, I don't know who started, were the same as the Faraday Society transactions. Both of them switched late 40s. And it has, I think, on one or two occasions had joint meetings with other societies. I think in Honolulu they had one with the Japanese Chemical Society. By and large, there was this inimical feeling between ACS and ECS for a long time. It probably doesn't exist now. But it didn't have that kind of relationship with any other. And I think the one with the ACS was predominantly the personal animosity between Fink and Parsons, which probably grew out of the fact that Parsons wanted to get out. I mean, Fink wanted to get out. So now with industrial sponsors, it was pretty good. Certain industrial sponsors, Dow and some of the others, companies that were interested in this general area. Chloralkali industry obviously had an interest. As I told you, Aluminum Company of America was interested through Bob Mears, who recognized the value of basic electrochemistry to his problems, his research and development problems. So I think there were a dozen or so industrial sponsors, maybe two dozen industrial sponsors, who looked on the society with great interest. And they're the ones you'd expect them to be, the ones that were in the field.
What kind of support did they, in addition to supporting their employees and attending meetings and things like that?
Well, they took out these ads in the journal, what do you call them? Not house ads, but institutional kinds of ads. The Nickel Company.
Okay.
And that's all I had to say. So they did that kind of thing. I think occasionally sponsored symposia of interest to them, put up some money to help bring speakers in. Or sent people to meetings, which was very important to us. And interestingly enough, we published a lot of papers that came out of industrial research labs. I'm sure the publication came after the patent, if there was such. But I'd say that, and I can't guarantee if this is true, but I think it is, that the percentage of papers that came from industrial labs total were higher and that this journal and these and the other journals, including industrial engineering, chemistry, and the chemical engineering, all the rest of those things, publish CHE journal, the papers, because many of them come out of academia. But we published a lot of industrial papers.
Well, I think this was also a time when industry was changing, and it wasn't this terrible secrecy that at the early part of the century companies had.
Mm-hmm.
And they recognized that it was important to, once you already protected yourself through patents, that
the interaction was valuable.
Yeah.
Of course, that was the root of the Gordon conferences. Not only between the academia and the industry, but across the industry. So, anyway, I wouldn't be surprised that maybe half our papers, certainly back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, were industrial. The various divisions, there have been lots of co-sponsored symposia, and that's about the best way that they do it. That is, industrial electrolytic would get together with physical electrochemistry, and they'd have a symposium on mass transfer, for example, which was of interest to both sides. As I said, the semiconductor things, I think, stemmed out of dielectric and insulation. And there are dielectric materials which you just displace an atom here or there, you can get a semiconductor out of it. If you heat or cool it, you can get a conductor or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Physical electrochemistry, I think at one time it was called theoretical electrochemistry, but that word dropped out when theoretical chemistry became more powerful. Theoretical or physical electrochemistry was very frequently a co-sponsor with each of the other divisions, corrosion, insulation, all the rest of them. When the society decided to publish in two parts in the same journal, solid state and electrochemistry, the interaction was predominant in each of these divisions rather than across the divisions, although occasionally there would be some across the dividing line. So I'd say internally that the various divisions interact quite nicely with each other. They don't have nearly as, for a long time, they haven't had the disciplinary plenum that other, that are university has. They recognize the importance of knowing some of them across the fence, and so they get together and do it. So that part works very well in this society.
At first glance, when you look at the various divisions, they almost look so diverse you wonder how they could interact with each other.
Some of them do, yeah. For example, it's hard to see where electro-organic would fit except with physical electrochemistry in terms of reaction rates, orders, and things of that sort. But by virtue of the fact that it's not a big outfit and the guys at the banquet sit together and talk to each other, you produce the sessions five years down the line.
Mm-hmm.
That's, if you look at the coming meetings, you'll find that there are a lot of interactive symposium, quite a few. And it may be that it's now happening in other societies, but not nearly as much as I think.
Well, that certainly builds a stronger organization when you
right.
have that kind of interaction.
Absolutely.
We did touch on number 10 briefly, but I think we just skipped over it here. I don't know whether you want to add anything else. The relationship between the academic and industrial contingents. We talked about this couple times earlier.
Well, in the sense that this is a more intimate group, a society, it works out pretty well. They certainly don't just isolate from one another. I think it was a lot better in the earlier days than it is now, maybe, or than it might have been for some years in the recent past. Of course, in the earlier days, the academic was in the minority. the 60s and 70s and 80s, they began to be the majority, I think. And there may have been, I was going to use the word antagonism, but that's not a proper word. There may have been some indifference one to the other, because cooperation has never been as productive as the cooperatives would like it to be. And, you know, you begin to shake your finger at the system that says cooperate when you don't gain as much as you think you ought to. But it certainly is as good as any other group, and maybe better because it's smaller. And the interest is on the field rather than on their own bailiwick.
Number 12, how has the society contributed or reacted to significant scientific events in electrochemistry and related fields?
Well, it's generally been on its toes. In fact, it might have been on its toes too much during the cold fusion business. Although that hasn't been laid to rest by any manner of means. But it did get involved quickly in that one, and had a number of conferences and symposia, a number of debates, and sometimes rather hot debates. But by and large, it reacted to the business of semiconductor systems as electrochemical arenas very quickly. Early in the game, the business of dealing with microelectronic systems came up. Silicon, Gallium arsenide were in the very early parts of the journal. It was a sizable player in STM. In using it as a tool, that is, it didn't help invent it, but it quickly used it. It was very important, it seems to me, in developing the aspect that if one used electrochemical instrumentation, you had means of control which you hadn't had before. Therefore, you ought to go back and look at your problems with the fresh instruments, because you might find that you were wrong in the first place with the information you had. I think it did that pretty quickly and pretty well. It got into the game of sensors right at the beginning.
Let's see if that's... I think we're all right now.
Okay.
Yeah. We were talking about point number 12.
Yeah. I started to say that the use of electronic instrumentation for potentiostats, for example, for measuring electrochemical inductance spectra, that kind of thing. The society reacted quickly in publishing papers on these things, sensors. In fact, there's a sensor. You don't have to hold it. There's a sensor division now. So I'd say that the nose for news is pretty good in that society. As it, you know, got deeply involved in cold fusion because there were two electrochemists that first spoke about it. The business of maintaining good potential control, for example, is very important in lots of electrochemical processes, lots of free radical processes. The organic chemists
came back into the field. For a long time, organic electrochemistry was very empirical. But now, if you look through the JACS or other journals that publish a lot of organic papers, electrochemistry is scattered all through them. They don't show up in this society particularly anymore. But the use of electrochemical process procedures in synthetic chemistry is first rate. And the society recognized that in a hurry. The answer to the 13 is straightforward. It really is a very responsive society. The number of layers of bureaucratic layers is just small enough so you can get things through. They can't always do something for you, but they hear you and respond. And on 14, I'd say that using the sinusoidal nature of that question, that financial ways have always been the problem.
Okay.
I think the society looks very carefully, it always did in my time with them, at the journal and at the meetings. And those are the two important things. Those are the only two things that are of any consequence. Everything else is sort of, maybe not frivolous, but peripheral. And they've always been very careful to keep that in the center of their attention. And on an almost daily basis worry about whether the meetings are doing what they're supposed to or the journals doing what they're supposed to. And I think that's pretty important.
Ron, as you said earlier, that's technical orientation is foremost.
Yeah.
Over anything
over
else.
Everything
compared
else.
To ACS, who goes off and does all kinds of other
yeah,
things.
Yeah, worries about the wages and accreditation and all that kind of stuff. And about their own position in Washington. Well, 15's a great broad question, but obviously I met lots of people from whom I gathered understanding of the field and with whom I had sometimes deeply embedded contacts with industry and other institutions, but with industry predominantly. So the society, although I didn't join it for that reason, and I didn't stay in it for that reason, the society has certainly been very good to me in terms of making accessible individuals I might not have run across otherwise. I would never have seen Laqui just offhand. As Vice President of Research and Development for INCO, he wouldn't have come down here to look for people. Mears was Director of Research at Alcoa. I was a young squirt. Chances I'd never see him. So it was good. And again, it's the smallness, I think, that makes a difference.
Did it help you to place your students?
Directly, no. No. Indirectly, yes. I'm trying to think of a place where it was critical to the placement of the student. I can't.
Okay.
It was useful, but never critical. I'd have a student who would want to go to a certain part of the country, but he wanted to be an industrial chemist in the Northeast, say. It would help them to know that. But it was never the final word on placement.
what it's doing now, but better. I mean that. The business of expanding responsibility and coverage, you do at the expense of the intimacy that I think this society provides. Now, it ought to always look as to whether there is a future for electrochemistry, because after all, it broke away when it was readily definable and delineated. It now has worked itself around to being an integral part of the field, and maybe it's not necessary anymore. But I certainly don't visualize anything which would suggest that if it were part of the ACS, it wouldn't be a division. And if it were a division, it would be more like the ACS than it is like the electrochemical society. So for the long foreseeable future, I'd say that electrochemistry will be looked at as a field, and this is a good society. The fact of the matter is, that's what's happened to ACS, APS, American Institute of Biological Sciences. They've spawned small groups who are more homogeneous. Now, that can be bad in the sense that interdisciplinarity is not as clear. You begin to dig deep trenches and you can't see over the sides. Electrochemistry itself is an interdisciplinary activity. It's not a single item. If it were part of anything, it's part of interface science. The only difference between the grosser interface science and this is that you handle a charge across an interface. That's what makes electrochemistry. It's an oxidizing or a reducing agent, just like any chemical oxidizing or reducing agent, except that you can control the potential a little better. And under the right circumstances, you can meter the electrons in and out better. You can tell how fast to go before you saturate the system, all that kind of stuff. But it's got enough roots in enough different places, so I think I don't see any reason to believe it'll disappear as a specialty for a long time.
Did it ever attract physicists?
Yeah. It doesn't attract high energy physicists, except to voice a problem about cold fusion. But but it attracts the atomic molecular and AMOS, atomic molecular optical and spectroscopists. Are attractive. Many of them are. They work in the field, they do good work. Now, we used to publish papers by out of physics departments, people doing particularly electronic stuff, that is solid state stuff. The guys who do solid state conductivity are generally physicists rather than chemists. Superconductivity would fall into this, charge carriers and solids. It hasn't done it, because I think maybe the people who are involved with this society don't have a sufficient theoretical background, solid state theory background. But it's spread. It's got tentacles all over. But it after all, is a great part of the electroanalytical is a great part of analytical. Organic. It owns the one of the maybe the only law that's inviolable, except maybe the second law is inviolable. But Faraday's law is inviolable. It's just a product of charge times numbers. Mm-hmm. Now there've been. In fact, there's a guy in here who wrote to me saying I found a way around Faraday's law. You know, you guys don't know what you're talking about. I remember getting a paper from the University Witwatersrand many years ago showing how Faraday's laws could be violated. That is, you got more than electrochemical equivalence. And it was all measuring problems, as it always has been. Because it's a very simple thing. It's N times E minus charge on the Avogadro's number times charge. There aren't many laws like that.
Never thought about it that way, but yes. Well, we sort of finished this list. Is there anything else you wanted to say in a general sense about the Electrochemical Society?
Well, I certainly wish it well, and I think it does an important and good job, which for the foreseeable future should be continued. I hate to see it amalgamate with anything. I hate to see it expand too rapidly or too unnecessarily. It ought to always look around to see what it is that belongs to it or that could be served by it. But that's about all I would do. It's a good template for other small societies because it's got the longest history, I think.
Yes, almost 100 years now.
So yeah, and I see the others are all much more recent, you know, post-60s, post-70s. So it's nice to have a system that you can look back on and see that works for almost 100 years. Hello?
Well, thank you very much for spending a couple hours with me today.
It's nice to see you again.
And appreciate it.